less than 2 days away from Rosh Hashanah, certainly it is a dover b'ito, a timely matter to discuss the very special and powerful day of Rosh Hashanah, Habah Aleinu Latova. And I wanted, as is our custom, as we approach the Moadim, to devote the first part of our discussion to a halachic matter, and from there to move on to more thematic issues. Of course, the halachic object that is the subject of Rosh Hashanah is the shofar, and we've addressed in the past a number of aspects of the mitzvah of tkiyas shofar, and of particular interest this evening is what I would like to speak about specifically because in its time, in the times of the Rishonim, it was a major discussion. And in our times, you almost wouldn't hear of it if you hadn't gone looking. Even for people who are quite halachically conscious. And I think that is in large part a tribute to the power of minhag, as we will see. The question relates to the shevarim. As we know, of course, the Torah discusses two types of sounds. There's the tkiyah, which is the continuous, unbroken sound. And then there is what the Torah calls teruah, which is the broken sound. Now, what exactly is the teruah that the Torah is speaking about? That itself becomes a discussion in the Gemara. Are they short points of sound, like a staccato sound, what we call the teruah? Or are they somewhat longer, relatively, lines of sound, still broken, but they're not just dots of sound. They have some type of duration, what we call shevarim. And this becomes the question, and the Gemara tells us that the Mishnah tells us one way, and the Braisa says another way, and Rabbi Avohu in Caesarea, he brought them all together, and from that point on we do shevarim, and we do teruah, and we do shevarim teruah, just to cover all possibilities. Okay. What are the parameters in terms of the duration of these sounds? Well, the tkiyah and the teruah are relatively straightforward. The duration of a teruah, as we mentioned, is a point of sound. I mean, how many of them there are, that we will see. But a piece of a teruah is a syllable long. The tkiyah is interestingly defined by the duration of the teruah that it accompanies. And therefore, however long the collection of truer sounds are, that's how long the tekiah needs to be. And thus we will find, for example, that a tekiah, or one should find, for example, that the tekiah which accompanies the shivarim teruah, which is the longest sound in the middle, the tekiah will also be longer, because it needs to equal in length, in duration, the sound that it accompanies, or the collection of sounds that it accompanies. So the duration of a piece of teruah is clear, the duration of a tekiah is clear. What about a shevarim? How long does a shevarim need to be? And really the question is there a minimum length for a shevarim? And perhaps more to the point, is there a maximum length that a shevarim, a shevarim sound should not exceed? And this is a large discussion in the Rishonim. And interestingly, it has its roots. The roots of the duration of the shevarim has its roots in a discussion about the teruah, as we will see. And as we ask questions that we would never imagine there's more than one answer to, that's only because we forgot that we're Jewish, and the more we look into the sources, the more we will see. The Mishnah tells us that a teruah, what we call a teruah, is shalosh yevavos. Three yevavos. The major question will be, what is a yevavah? Well, Rashi tells us that a yevava is a syllable of sound, a point of sound. That means, with Rashi's definition of yevava as one point, then when the Mishnah defines a teruah as three yevavos, that means that the staccato collection of a teruah is 3 points long. That's it. Toot, toot, toot. And that's the end. Now, we, of course, have never heard anything like that. But that's the opinion of Rashi. And again, because Yevava is 1 point, and the Truah is three Yevavas, the Truah equals 3 points. Much more familiar to us will be the opinion of the Rivah and the Rivom, both of them of the Baalei HaTosfos, for they state that actually a Yevavah is not a point. A Yevavah is a collection of 3 points. Which means now when the Mishnah says that a Teruah is 3 Yevavos, it is a collection of 3 collections of 3. That is to say, a Teruah, the full Teruah, has 9 points to it. And that indeed is the case, as we know. The minimum amount for a Teruah are 9 syllables. However, it is a Machlokas. That is to say, there are 2 opinions on the table, but of course in our experience we understand, and perhaps not surprisingly, we take the course of stringency. No shul will ever have a Teruah that is merely 3 syllables, except for Rashi's shul. All of them will have at least 9, and one can add, sometimes once the Baal Tokeah gets going with a Teruah, there's no stopping him, but the minimum of 9. So we follow the course of stringency. It's a Torah mitzvah. It's not surprising. What's interesting is, and this is where the Shevarim enter, when we come to consider the 2 opinions as to whether Teruah is 3 points or 9 points, so even as we follow the opinion of Rivah and Rivom to be stringent, we need to be aware that in the wings of Rashi's opinion is its own stringency, of Rashi's opinion that a Teruah is 3 points. There's a stringency that exists there. How so? We mentioned that the duration of a tekiah sound is defined by the length of the Teruah. That is to say, what the Teruah, its duration collectively, that's the duration of the tekiah that accompanies it. According to Rashi, a Teruah is 3 points long. 3 syllables of sound long. A corollary of that opinion is, if we say that a teruah is 3 points long, and if we say that a tekiah is the sound that accompanies a teruah, it will emerge that any continuous sound that is 3 points of sound long, at least, is a tekiah, is defined as a tekiah. Now, if that is the case, then when we come to consider what we call shevarim, there will be a stringency in Rashi's position. Namely, one will have to be particular that each of those 3 broken sounds, each of those 3 shvarim, should itself not be 3 syllables of sound long. Because if they are, then they have instantly left the category of shvarim, and they're actually tekios. And one's meant to be doing shvarim at that time. And therefore, there is a maximum duration of 2 syllables. For Shvarim. They are very short bursts. It is barely more than a dot. But it can't be what we call a Shvarim, because if we consider the Shvarim the way we hear them, they will last 3 points long, each of those 3. They're not those shorter sounds. But according to Rashi, they need to be. So how do we explain our practice? Well, the simple answer is that we follow the opinion, again, of the Rivah and the Rivom, completely. That is to say, not only do we follow it in interest of stringency, that is to say, that when it comes to the Teruah, we require 9 and not 3, but we also follow that opinion in the interest of leniency. That is to say, if we define the Teruah as 9 points and not as 3 points, then any continuous sound that is less than 9 points long will not be a tekiah yet, and therefore your shevarim, which is only 3 points long, is perfectly fine. That is to say, if we set the minimum sounds of the Teruah as 9, then the minimum threshold for the accompanying tekiah would be 9 points long. And certainly one no longer has to worry that the shevarim are entering into the category of tekiah. And therefore it's important to realize the full weight of our minhag, which is to follow the opinion of Rivah and Rivom, to define a Teruah as 9 points, as we said, not only the Chumrah, to require 9 points for the Teruah, but also the Kula, the Shevarim can be 3 syllables long, they could be 4 or 5 syllables long, as long as they're nowhere near 9, we're nowhere near a Tekiah, we're safely yet in the zone of Shevarim. So we have before us a Machlokas, and as we said, the length of the Shevarim depends on the amount of teruas. That's the way it goes. It's most interesting to note that there are some Rishonim who maintain that even if we define the trua as Rashi does, that it's 3 points, still one doesn't need to worry that the Shevarim shouldn't be 3 points of time in duration. Why not? Did we not just say that if the trua is 3 points, then a tekiya that's 3 points long is already a tekiya? So a Shevarim can't be that long, otherwise it won't be a Shevarim anymore. Why does one not need to worry? Says the Mordechai, very simply, in fact, disturbingly simply, we have to remember that when we sound what we call a teruah, which are the points, the dots of sound, and a shivarim, which are the short bursts of sound, we do so because we are satisfying all possibilities as to what a teruah could be. Now, if that's the case, then even if we say that a teruah is 3 points of sound, and within the context of a teruah, a single sound, which is 3 points long, is a tekiya, which it is, that is, as we move into Shevarim, we're redefining what a trua is. As if to say, if it's dots, then it's a trua. But as we move into Shevarim, that's because maybe the trua are not the dots. Maybe the trua are the broken sounds of the Shevarim. But as we come to redefine the trua, so then by definition, we must also redefine what a tekiya is. A tekiya within the context of Shevarim is no longer the sound that might accompany the trua, which we're no longer dealing with, but it's got to be the sound that accompanies three Shevarim. And three Shevarim, of course, are much longer than three dots of sound. And therefore, in simpler terminology, says the Mordechai, we can't cross wires. We can't borrow definitions from a tekiya that accompanies a sound that we're no longer dealing with. When in the zone of terua, define your tekiya vis-a-vis the number of truas, trua dots. But when you're in the zone of the shevarim, so you can leave behind the definition of tekiya as it would be accompanying the trua. And you can redefine in terms of a collection of shevarim. And each shevar can certainly be three syllables long. So it's such a compelling argument that essentially what it boils down to is whether or not the Shevarim sound and the Teruah sound are exclusive one to the other, as if to say, if it's a Shevarim, if the Teruah of the Torah is a Shevarim, it's not a Teruah. And if it's a Teruah, it's not a Shevarim. It's either or, one has to choose. Or perhaps all of them are okay. And this is the famous discussion of Rav Haigon. Although it seems on the face of it that when the Gemara discusses, perhaps it's a teruah, perhaps it's a shevarim, it sounds like we don't know. And because we don't know, that we do all of them to satisfy all possibilities. But Rav Haigon says that in fact, any broken sound is acceptable. Teruah means broken. Ra'uah means broken. Ratzutz. So if it's broken into dots or broken into lines, they're all fine, min ha-Torah. What Rabbi Avohu did was not so much to satisfy all possibilities, but to unify all practices. Because some people were doing a shevarim, and some people were doing teruahs, and therefore Rabbi Avohu didn't want a situation where one person who's used to doing the teruah as dots, and he'll be visiting his family for 1 year in Rosh Hashanah, and they do shevarim, and they do lines, and then he'll never go to that shul again. So post-Rabbi Abba, we'll have to find another reason not to go to that shul again. But in terms of the shofar, and what if we need anything on Rosh Hashanah, more than anything else, it's unity, and therefore every shul does everything. So you'll never be a stranger. If you do shevarim and they do teruahs, and you all do both anyway. But it's an amazing way of looking at these different possibilities because they're not exclusive anymore. It's not a question of right or wrong. They're all okay. But because they're all okay, then the definition of tekiya may be defined as it accompanies a trua, even if you're dealing with a tekiya that accompanies a shevarim. In other words, if it's no longer an exclusive question, but rather they're all acceptable, then the lowest common denominator of a tekiya, even as it features with a terua, will carry through into the other sounds, and one will need to be conscious of not elongating a shevarim past three syllables of sound. That is how they explain the opinion of Rashi. So this is quite, in its own way, an involved question. And as I said, more than anything else, we'd never know, because I'm not aware of any shul, at least during the services, during the tefillah, that will have these short shevarim. But it's fascinating to note that according to many, in the opinion of Rashi, one does not fulfill the mitzvah of shevarim which is possibly truer with such long shvarim as we do them. But nonetheless, gadol koach haminhag, the halach has been decided like the rivah and the rivam. There's 9 points in a truer sound, which means that if a shvarim is 3 points long, no problem whatsoever. That said, there are many kehillas who get together after tefillah, and they go through all the combinations and permutations and possibilities, and they go through the shvarim and the teruah, and shvarim teruah in accordance with the opinion of Rashi with those short bursts. So if you hear people blowing the shofar again when davening is finished, now you know why. So from the halakhas of shofar, let's come to discuss some of the themes of Rosh Hashanah. It's most fascinating to note, and if we only stop noting it because we get used to it, that we say so much on Rosh Hashanah, and the machzor is full, and they're only getting thicker. But we miss out Hallel. In other words, if there's anything that for us accompanies a special time, a moed, a chag, it's going to be Hallel. And we go straight from Shacharis into Laning, and there's no Hallel. What's it all about? So this question is raised by the Gemara. It's mentioned in two places, in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Lamed Beis, and in Erech and Daf Yud. And the Gemara there actually expresses it that the Malachi Hasharis asked this question. Why aren't you all saying Shira? Why aren't they saying Hallel? And the answer is important because it gives us an insight into the atmosphere of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It's not a straightforward business. The answer, says the Gemara, Amar Lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's not appropriate to say Hallel, not on Rosh Hashanah and not on Yom Kippur. Efshar Melech Yosef, can it be that the king is sitting, V'sifrei Chayim, V'sifrei Mesim, V'suchim Lefana? It's a serious day. The books of the living, the books of the dead are open in front of him. V'Yisrael Omrim Shira, and the Jewish people, they open up with Hallel. It's not a good fit. It's not appropriate. And so we don't say Hallel, which has a kind of a sobering effect, really, on the day, or should do. Mefarshim are quite intrigued by the expression that the Gemara uses, Sifrei Chayim v'Sifrei Mesim, the books of the living and the books of the dead. Why are the books of the departed open on Rosh Hashanah? I mean, the living are the ones that have been operating, for better or for worse, during the past year. So Sifrei Chayim should be open. Why are the Sifrei Mesim open? Indeed, Al Derech HaPshat, there are Mefarshim who explain that Sifrei Chaim and Sifrei Mesim do not refer to people who are alive or who have departed, but rather they refer to the two possibilities for those who are living, either those who are to be inscribed in Sifrei Chaim or Chalila in Sifrei Mesim. And thus, both books are open. They represent the two possibilities for those who are yet alive. However, there is perhaps another way to understand this expression, the concept of Sifrei Chaim and Sifrei Mesim. We should know, one of the individuals, like everyone else in the Tanakh, quite complicated, who is associated very closely with the concept of tshuva, is Menashe ben Chizkiah. It's Menashe Melech Yehuda. Menashe led a rather evil existence, wicked existence, while he was alive for most of the time. And in the end, he did tshuva. The Gemara says in Perek Chelek, and where all of these things are discussed, the Gemara says that the Malachim objected to his doing tshuva. I mean, as they say in the classics, Yesh Gevul. They felt that he'd just gone too far, and at the end to do tshuva, and they objected to receiving his tshuva. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepted him. And what's important for us, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is that when I accept Menashe's tshuva, so no one will ever despair of tshuva. Because no one can ever be like he was. And therefore, if I didn't accept him, so some people might despair because they'll think, well, maybe I'm like him. Not as bad, but no one will be worse than him. And therefore, if I accept Menashe, no one ever need worry. That's a waste of energy and time to worry that one's tshuva will not be accepted. Just think of Menashe, and that's not an issue anymore. What's most fascinating is the life and times and deeds of Menashe are described, of course, in Sefer Melachim, and that he was one of the Malchi Yehuda. That's in Melachim Beis, Perek Kaf Aleph. But the pasuk doesn't make any mention of the fact that he did tshuva. If you only ever read Sefer Melachim, you'd never know. So does it feature anywhere in the Tanakh? Well, it does, actually, because many of the major events of the Tanakh are actually recorded again, with a very specific purpose, in the Sefer Divrei Hayomim, the last of the Sefer Tanakh. And in Divrei Hayomim Beis, Perek Lamed Gimel, where it reviews the life of Menashe Melech Yehuda, it says, and in the end, he did tshuva, and Hashem accepted his tshuva. And this is highly intriguing, because in the main, Divrei Hayomim, as a review, to use an oversimplification, can only be reviewing things that were mentioned at the time, and then it will synopsize them. But to mention details, and what a detail! I mean, this is not a mere footnote. This is the redemption of Menashe Melech Yehuda. And if you don't get to Divrei Hayomim Beis, Perek Lamed Gimel, which is kind of towards the end of Tanakh, you never hear of it. How can it be missing from the real-time, so to speak, description, and only there in the review? That is the question. But we see from here a very profound yesod. The Navi in Yirmiyahu describes HaKadosh Baruch Hu's supervision of the world and his interaction with the world. Gedol ha'etza v'rav ha'alila, great counsel, great action, Rav Halilia. Asher einecha pekuchos al darche b'nei adam, Hashem's eyes are open, so to speak, on people's ways. V'laseis le'ish kidrachav v'kepri ma'alalav. And to dispense to each person in accordance with his ways, kidrachav v'kepri ma'alalav, the fruits of his deeds. And the question that attracts the attention of many Mefarshim is, what is the meaning of these two expressions? Drachav, his ways, and prima alalav, the fruits of his deeds. I mean, are those two ways of saying the same thing? Says Rabbi Yeshua Heller, in his Perish Told Us Yeshua on Pirkei Avos, every deed that a person does actually needs to be examined from two aspects. Number one, there is the deed itself, for better or for worse, for good or bad. But every deed, in addition to its own happening, also has consequences. It also has effects. And those effects also need to be considered. So for example, if a person does a mitzvah, he may give tzedakah. Giving tzedakah is a great mitzvah. But the assessment of that deed is not restricted to the deed. Because what happens if someone sees him give tzedakah and is thus inspired that they would also give tzedakah? So this person, his way was to give tzedakah, but the fruits of his deeds exist outside of him. Somebody saw him, was inspired by him, sought to emulate him. And certainly, as we can appreciate, if one brings someone else closer to Torah, then in a sense, the entire Torah living and Torah life of the second person, the one who is mekarev him, they are fruits of his deeds, and he has a certain part in all of those deeds. And this is assuming there's just two people in the equation. There is no question that it goes on and further and further. Of course, unfortunately, we don't like to talk of it or to think of it, but the same could be true if a person in the opposite. If someone does something wrong, other people seek to emulate that bad example. The fruits of his deeds are in the deeds of someone else. And so, the Sefer Pachad Yitzchak, not the one that we normally quote of Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner, Zatzal, but an earlier Sefer, Pachad Yitzchak, from Rabbi Yitzchak Lampronti, who was one of the great rabbis of Italy in the 1700s. He was one of the two rebbes of the Ramchal, actually, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. And he was the first one to systematically organize Torah discussions in alphabetical order. He had a multi-volume encyclopedia, really cool, Pachad Yitzchak. It was just him. And under letter Taf, in the entry of Tshuva, he discusses Menashe Melech Yehuda. And he states, What will we say about Menashe? Very little positive to say about the life that he led. He did many, many things wrong. But he did more than that, unfortunately. Because as Melech Yehuda, not only did he himself lead a wrong lifestyle, but he also initiated and encouraged nationwide Avodah Zarah, as the Pasuk describes. In our terms, we would say that his own personal conduct was derachav. The behavior of the Jewish people, at his encouragement and at his instigation and under his auspices, is prima alalav. They're the fruits of his deeds. Now, at the end of his life, he does tshuva, and this is the very sensitive point. Because he does tshuva, what does he fix? Well, he corrects his ways. What about the Jewish people? Did they all stop worshipping Avodah Zarah just because Menashe stopped? Unfortunately, no. Which means he set in motion a process that he was unable to reverse, even as he reversed his own personal behavior. Or in our terminology, he was able to rectify derachav, his personal ways, but prima alalav was out of his hands. And what shall we say? It happens to be that in the case of Menashe, there was a happy ending, but it wasn't of his doing. Namely, if the issue that he was at the root of was Avodah Zarah, that continued for a good long while. But in the days of the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, there's a famous description of the Talmud, it's in the 7th Perek of Yuma and in the 2nd Perek of Sanhedrin, that they managed to destroy the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. Meaning, as a nationwide pursuit, idol worship ceased when the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah made it back to Eretz Yisrael for the Second Commonwealth. They davened that it should be destroyed. They said, we weren't able to handle it. It was the result of the cause of our first Golus. Here we are back again. It's just a matter of time. If it isn't taken away, they davened it should be taken away, which is a rather extreme measure. Well, once that's true, then the full rectification, or at the very least, the full cessation of Menashe's life's exploits happened. Finally, what he had set in motion came to an end. For there was no more Avodah Zarah, certainly not as a nationwide issue. Says the Pachad Yitzchak, this is what is being intimated to us by the fact that the teshuva and the success of the teshuva of Menashe Melech Yehuda is mentioned not in Sefer Malachim, but in Sefer Divrei Hayomim. The difference between those two Sfarim is that Sefer Malachim was written by Chizkiyahu HaMelech, and at that time, Menashe's sin was not fixed completely, perhaps in terms of drachov, but not in terms of its effect. Sefer Divrei Hayomim was written by the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah. That means that it was written at a time when everything that Menashe had set in motion had finally come to a halt. And therefore, when his tshuva was complete, that's when it gets its entry into the Tanakh. So this is a very powerful idea. And it's interesting to note that it has a reverberation much later on. It echoes in an episode that is mentioned in the Gemara in Maseches Brachos, in the 4th Perek Daf Kaf Ches Amud Beis, which tells of the final moments of the life of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who did so much. And in the end, Kishachala Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Nichnasu Tamidav Levakar, so his Tamidim came to visit him and to take leave from him. Says the Gemara, Kevan Shira Osam, as soon as he saw his disciples coming, Hischa Livkos, they began to cry. So they asked him, why are you crying? And he said, because he was afraid. He was unsure which direction would he be heading once he passes from this world. At that point, his Talmidim said to him, Rabbeinu Barchenu. They asked for a bracha. And he gave them a bracha for good living. His bracha was actually very interesting. He blessed them that they should always fear heaven the way they fear the person next to them. which they were initially insulted at such a mundane sounding bracha, until he described to them that if it's actually quite a high madrega. Shehemora shamayim aleichem kemora basa vadam. Okay, that's the bracha. Mefarshim ask, the timing of this episode is rather difficult. Here's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He senses that he's nearing the end. And when his Talmidim come to visit him, he sees them and he starts to cry. And why is he crying? Because he's afraid. So why does he wait for his Talmidim to come? It seems to be a very personal thing. But it sounds like when he saw them, he started crying. What's more disturbing, just if we take the story as a line, is that after he expresses all of this fear, which must have been a very emotion-laden moment, he's telling him asking for a bracha. Which sounds like they're not particularly sensitive to his concerns. Here he is, he's in tears, why are you upset? He tells him why he's upset, and his Talmidim seem to take the attitude of, well, sorry to hear it, but in any case, time is of the essence, so can we have a bracha, please? And then we'll leave you to it. Seems somewhat insensitive. Says Rav Simcha Zissel of Kelm, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai shouldn't have to be that worried as to which direction he is headed in. Number one, his life is full of mitzvahs. And number two, if there's anything wrong, so let him do tshuva instead of fear per se. Let him channel it in a positive way. And then he'll know. He should have confidence in tshuva. When he saw his Talmidim, he began to cry. What have they done? When he saw his Talmidim, it made him conscious of the fact that the question as to his accounting is not restricted to his own personal conduct. He has taught Talmidim. And if for some reason he suspects himself that he has failed to educate them and to inspire them and instruct them correctly, he could yet be held at fault for their mistakes. And therefore the entry of the Talmidim made him alert to the implications of their actions for his liability, for his accountability. And that's why he began to cry. It's very difficult to know how to defend against that. He can do his best. And that's what he expressed to them. His fate, to a certain degree, is in their hands. And that is why the Talmidim responded with a request for a bracha. As if to say, if your fear is that we will not live up to the best of your education, so we request of you a bracha that we should help us. Help us to emulate you in the best possible way, that you should never come to grief over a shortcoming in our conduct. And that was how he responded with the bracha. The implications of this idea, which is such a powerful idea, that it's not only the stone as it's dropped that's judged, but also the ripples as they emerge, explains to us how the Gemara stated on Rosh Hashanah, not only are the books of the living open, but also the books of the departed. Sifrei Chaim v'Sifrei Meisim pesuchim lefanav. Our question was, well, who has been active? Who needs to be judged for the past year? The Chaim have been active. Why the Sifrei Meisim? If it refers to people that have already departed, why are their books open? Says Rabbi Shua Heller, because it may be that they have not been active, but nonetheless, their actions during their time in this world have yet borne fruit. Hopefully in a positive direction, but it's a reckoning. It needs to be accounted for. Not only Sifrei Chaim, but also Sifrei Meisim. Someone who inspired others. So even as their children take on a continue a Torah lifestyle, and their children's children, and he has been departed from the world for a number of years, but his book is opened again, because Durachov came to an end so many years ago, but Prima Alalov continue. And this brings us to a fascinating observation with regards to something that we say in the Tefillah on Rosh Hashanah. The bracha of Zichronos, or the central of the three special brachas of Rosh Hashanah, begins Ata zocher ma'asei olam. Vokeid kol yitzurei kedem. We say to Hashem, you remember, it seems, everything. Which itself seems somewhat obvious. But that's how we begin. Ata zocher ma'asei olam. What is the meaning of these words? Hashem remembers everything. It sounds like, what are we saying? We're saying HaKadosh Baruch Hu has infinite recall. He is a repository of information of everything that ever happened. Ata zocher ma'asei olam. How does that relate to us? Don't know. But it's important to establish. Says Rav Dessler in the Michtav Meliyahu, we're saying something else entirely. When we say, when we preface and open the bracha of Zichronos with the words, Ata zocher ma'asei olam, we say that Hashem remembers everything, it's not an issue of historical recollection. It's an issue of a current calculation. That is to say, we express that HaKadosh Baruch Hu remembers every deed that was ever done in terms of the implications that that deed had for every deed that was done this past year. And at this point, the mind boggles. Because of all the generations that existed, and each one has, each person and every deed that he did has his contribution, together with so many other causes, which then roll into other causes, and hundreds of years later, the Jewish people, as they are, have acted the way they have, and have lived their year the way that they have. But so much of their actions are the product, for better or for worse, of influences on them, which are themselves the product of sub-influences and co-causes. And to take all of those myriad acts from so long ago and judge each act in terms of putting it into the collection, the almost infinite connection of causes, and to assess how it affected any given act so many hundreds of years later, that's already something way beyond the issue of recollection. That's an issue of assessment. Every deed, whenever it happened, is assessed anew every year on Rosh Hashanah. Every act of tzedakah decades ago that inspired someone, and he led a life of tzedakah, and now his great-grandchildren are leading a life of tzedakah, that act is again recalled. That is the full impact of Ata Zocher Ma'asei Olam, and that sets the tone really for our own contemplations of our actions throughout the year. So having discussed some aspects of Zichronos, let us come back to the shofar. In physical terms, it is and should be the center of the day. And I'd like to take an interesting angle at the mitzvah of the blowing of the shofar. It comes from one of the greats of the Hasidim, the Bnei Yisoschar, Reb Tzvi Elimelech Shapira of Dinov. And he begins by noting something of a conflict in the way that the mitzvah of shofar is discussed. On the one hand, so much is said about the mitzvah of shofar. In the words of Chazal, in the words of Rishonim, it signifies this, it signifies this, and there's room for all of them. Rav Sajagon lists his famous 10 explanations, and the 10 is not an exhaustive list. But together with that, we find a theme that runs through the words of Chazal and beyond, that we don't really know what shofar is about. There's a certain insistence that we don't really know. And it's a bit striking, because when the Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah on Daf Tet Zayin begins to open up the question of the shofar and ask the question, why do we blow the shofar? Lama tokim ba shofar. And the response of the Gemara is swift and final, it seems. Says the Gemara, Lama tokim? Why do we blow? Rachmana amartaka. God said in the Torah to blow the shofar. Now that's the type of response that can cut many discussions short. We're just getting involved, or hoping to get involved. What's the meaning of the shofar? And it's shut down. Why? Torah says. What type of question is that? Well, it's actually the type of question that the Gemara asks a lot. And we never find that type of answer that, you know. Why do we do the following? Because the Torah says. I mean, ultimately, of course, that's the answer, but there's no room for any other discussion. I mean, You could stop a lot of conversations that way. And it's interesting to consider that even the Rambam, as he offers his famous insight into shofar, which interestingly is not in Hilchas Shofar, but it's in Hilchas Tshuva. And of course the Rambam says that the sound of the shofar, it's an alarm. Because on Rosh Hashanah, people should be alarmed. It's to wake us up. Because the person who drifts during the year is asleep, and he needs to be awake. Even when he's awake, he's asleep. He needs to be awakened. Uri Yishenim Mishen Askem. Wake up. But as the Rambam introduces that explanation, he does so with the words, Af al pi she mitzvah shofar gezeiras hakosov, even though, at the end of the day, the mitzvah of shofar, we don't know. It's a divine decree. We do it because the Torah said, Yom Teruah Yelachem, and that's why. Mikol mokom remez yeshba. Nonetheless, there is an illusion. It's very interesting. The Rambam is almost like he's treading very carefully around the mitzvah of shofar. He doesn't come in and say, the mitzvah of shofar means the following, which he does in other mitzvahs. He is at pains to point out that even though it's a gezeiras hakosov, which is really it echoes what the Gemara said, that the Torah said to blow, and that's pretty much that. But the Rambam almost excuses himself for having established and affirmed that it's a gezeiras hakosov to proceed then to offer some type of allusion or meaning to the mitzvah. So why is everyone... There seems to be a kind of a value in preserving a relationship with the mitzvah of shofar, to be conscious of the fact that we don't really know what shofar is all about. More so than in other mitzvahs. It's interesting to point out that one could say everyone that we've mentioned, the Gemara and the Rambam, they take their cue from the Pasuk. For although the Pasuk doesn't qualify or characterize the mitzvah of shofar, it just says, blow the shofar like it says the other mitzvahs. But of course, in the famous presentation of the mitzvah of shofar in Tehillim, Tikkun v'chodesh shofar b'kesel yom chageinu, which is the mitzvah of shofar, the Pasuk goes on to say, ki chok li Yisrael. It's a chok, and chok is the mitzvah whose reason we don't know. And therefore the Pasuk seems to be the first one to establish that ultimately shofar is a chok. And therefore any discussion is going to have to take that under advisement. You can't proceed to discuss shofar with the same confidence, or with the same expansiveness that perhaps you could other mitzvahs, because the Pasuk tells you it's a chok. That said, having referred to the Pasuk of Chok Li Yisrael, we should note, and of course having paused for a moment to absorb the connotation of the word chok, and chok is that we don't know. So that should accentuate the fact that the Pasuk goes on to say, chok li Yisrael hu, mishpat, lelokei Yaakov. Now, mishpat, of course, in a sense, is the antithesis of chok, because chok is a reason, a mitzvah whose reason is beyond us, and mishpat represents something which is eminently reasonable, makes perfect sense. So now we have actually something of a contradiction within the Pasuk. Is the mitzvah of shofar a chok, or is it a mishpat? That said, of course, we note that the Pasuk said it's a chok li Yisrael. It's a mishpat lelokei Yaakov. So for us it's a chok, for Hashem it's a mishpat. But what do we mean to say by that? Does that mean that even though we don't know the mitzvah, Hashem knows the mitzvah? Of course, Hashem knows the reason. But that's not normally stressed when we talk about chukos. When the paradumma comes in as a chok, the pasuk doesn't feel it necessary to say that, even though we don't know what it means, but Hashem knows what it means. Of course he knows what it means. So what's the value of concluding the pasuk by saying that it's a chok li Yisrael, but it's a mishpat lelokei Yaakov? Says the Bnei Yisachar, there's a certain irony that exists within the mitzvah of shofar. And it relates, of course, to the nature of Yom HaDin. Yom HaDin, which is a very, very serious day, right, the day of judgment of Rosh Hashanah, But we need to realize that it has been given a positive tone by the Torah. That is to say, it is a mishpat. But whereas the goal of mishpat, perhaps elsewhere, is to decide who is guilty and who is exonerated, who is vindicated, the goal of the mishpat of Rosh Hashanah is to ensure that as many people as possible are exonerated. It's not a neutral. There is an agenda, and the agenda is that everyone should be okay. There is a certain achrayus that behooves each person to act, to respond accordingly. But the stated aim and the definition of success of Rosh Hashanah is that everyone does well, not that we vetted out anyone who wasn't doing well. Now, what that means is that as far as possible, and of course when we talk about Kadosh Baruch Hu, we use the term possible in the loosest sense, but whereas things do need to follow some type of ma'arechet, there is a mishpat. But nonetheless, it is a mishpat that is set up that will augur well for Bnei Yisrael. And in a sense, this idea, this positive mishpat idea, is really what we say, it's the beginning of the piyut, lekel orech din, which we say it every day, Rosh Hashanah, both days, Shacharis and Musaf, Yom Kippur, lekel orech din. Says the Prima Godim in the Sefer Tevas Gome, Kael, we know, is the name of Chesed, Hashem Hashem Kael Rachel Mechanun. Din is justice. The two don't go together. But on Rosh Hashanah they do, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu they do. As Kael, as compassionate, he arranges the din. It still will have the trappings of din. It will still have to answer to some definition of din, but the canvas of Rosh Hashanah is that of Chesed, is that Lekel Orech Din. What are the implications for us on Rosh Hashanah? Mishpat is defined as measure for measure. Every cause and response, action and reaction. Positive action is rewarded positively, and negative action, negatively. That's what Mishpat's all about. What if we, the Jewish people, we hope that we have more merits than demerits, but what if the demerits are in the majority? The concept of action and reaction means the Jewish people should end up in a negative state, which we don't wish to happen. And therefore, there exists an avenue of success on the day of Rosh Hashanah, which is almost an executive route of action and reaction that can take us through. Namely, that the central mitzvah around which the day revolves is a chok. It is a chok type mitzvah. And the reason why is because to fulfill a mitzvah that has the chok quality is perhaps the best thing for the Jewish people on Rosh Hashanah. Because not only is it a merit, not only is it a good deed, but it's a good deed that we do and we don't know why. We can't explain it. It defies reason. Left to our own reason, we never would do this. But because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, and even though it doesn't make any sense to us, we pursue. That sets its own reaction. Because a merit such as a chok, and the blowing of the shofar as a chok, means that as HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to judge us, and perhaps reasonably we're not deserving, and the response to our individual actions perhaps should not be positive, but the response to the overarching mitzvah of the day of shofar, which is blown as a chok, creates its own reciprocation, whereby if we blow the shofar, even though we don't know why, but we're connected to Hashem, and He said to blow, so we blow. Can't explain it. Doesn't make sense rationally. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu's response to that merit is to judge us favorably, even though rationally or reasonably, that shouldn't be the verdict that we get. We've taken the entire day into this very specific chok zone, where we do our mitzvahs, even though we don't know why, so to speak. We shouldn't necessarily have done this act. Can't explain it. So that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will respond, midah keneged midah. It's an executive track within midah keneged midah, and respond positively, even though it defies explanation. And that, says the Bnei Yisoschar, is why we say, Ki chok li Yisrael hu, when Yisrael performed the mitzvah as a chok, that itself leads to Mishpat l'Elokei Yaakov. That's the basis of the Mishpat l'Elokei Yaakov. Because Mishpat is action and reaction. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's reaction to us performing a mitzvah as a chok is to give us a favorable judgment, so to speak, as a chok. Even though perhaps all reason may dictate otherwise. And this, I think, explains to us why it is that we see such insistence that as whoever discusses the mitzvah of shofar is at pains to keep it in a box which has chok written on over it. And we have to preface and offer disclaimers that we don't mean to say that it's not a chok. The worst thing we could do for the mitzvah of shofar is to fully understand it. Because as soon as we remove it from a chok, we remove from ourselves the outstanding and in a sense overarching and circumventing merit of performing a mitzvah of a chok. And therefore, all explanations for the mitzvah of shofar are all accepted, but they're never accepted as the actual answer. And if there's only one thing to say about the mitzvah of shofar, we give the answer that's the best answer we could give for on Rosh Hashanah, namely, we don't know. The Torah said to blow, it's good enough for us. And it's interesting to note that the central episode, the central merit, certainly historically, that we always recall on Rosh Hashanah is that of the Akedah. And we seem to take it aside from the others. And there's so many Zchus Avos. Avraham Avinu had 10 Nisyonos, not just one. And Yitzhak had his own achievements. And Yaakov, who isn't even mentioned here, somehow the Akedah is outstanding for us. And we make special mention of it. Why? What shall we say? The magnitude of the schus, there is no denying the magnitude of the act. But there is perhaps something else. And it was brought to my attention. I always try and say, Dover B'Shem Omro. And I must say, this was said over to me by my daughter, Sarah. I do believe we are finally getting our money's worth from the school. And this was told to them that what's unique about the Akedah is that Avraham Avinu had every reason in the world not to do it. It did not make sense. Not only did it not make sense on personal grounds, on moral grounds, but even on theological grounds and on Torah-based grounds. On every level, it did not make sense. The notion that he should follow through and kill Yitzchak, for a father to kill his son like that. And moreover, it has theological implications because HaKadosh Baruch Hu has already told him that Yitzchak will be the basis of the future of the Jewish people, and therefore to kill Yitzchak would be a nullification of the divine will as expressed to him. So the whole thing is getting tied up in knots. And indeed, this is something that is raised by Avram, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu finally tells him to the Malach, take him down, don't hurt him, don't touch him. At that point, Avram says, I'm completely confused. Initially, you told me, Kivi Yitzchak Yikar Lecha Zara. That's the Kriyas HaTorah for first day Rosh Hashanah. You told me that Yitzchak would be the future. Then you told me to kill him. And now you're telling me to take him down. So when it's all okay again, Avram respectfully requests an explanation of all of this. But when you think about it, the contradiction doesn't begin when he's told to take Yitzhak down. It begins when he's told to kill Yitzhak. Because you already have the conflict between Kivi Yitzhak Yikar Lechazara and Kaches Bin Chais Yechidcha Ba'alei Yisham. Already you have something that needs to be required, requires explanation, elucidation. And Avram didn't say anything. Because at the end of the day, here is Avram on every level of his cognition and of his sentiment and values, this shouldn't happen. But there's only one thing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to do it. And therefore, in spite of everything, it doesn't make sense, but he doesn't ask any questions. And he has questions. He doesn't raise any objections. And he has objections, and they're good. But all of that falls to the wayside in light of HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, that's the end of the story. Which means that the schus of the Akedah is not merely a great act. And of course, when we say merely, it's not restricted to the magnitude of the act. There's a certain quality to the act. It is the schus which Avram, whom we're claiming descendancy and hopefully emulation of as well, that he did this for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though on every level he should not have done this, and it, the opposite should have occurred. But nonetheless, we're connected, so he follows HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, we ask, Ba'akedas Yitzchak le'zara hayom barachamim tizkor. Remember the Akedah, that's how we conclude the bracha of Zichronus. For what we're saying is, perhaps you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you look at us, and maybe there's a number of reasons that we shouldn't really be favored. But Avram also had his reasons. And still, he's with you, you're his God, and he follows you, and therefore in spite, he put his reasons to the side, he put his objections to the side. That's the Midah connected Midah that we're looking to activate. And therefore perhaps you have objections to us, we'll try better, perhaps in the meanwhile we're somewhat objectionable, but remember Avram and respond accordingly. He set his objections to the side and came through for you, so you put your objections to the side and come through for us. And that's the way that we conclude. And it really resonates with the nature of the shofar as we described it as Chok LeYisrael. So these are some of the sentiments that I believe are well worthy of our attention and important to realize as well. As much as we began by stating from the Gemara, Rosh Hashanah is a serious day, but it's not a sad day. And as we discussed the fact that we don't say Hallel because it has that very, very somber, solemn aspect to it. But on the other hand, there's a Medrash which is quoted, it's a Psikta, I believe, is quoted by the Torah in the beginning of Pirkos Rosh Hashanah, that we do not approach this din the way other people approach din. When someone has a din pending, right, La Leinu, or someone has a din like that, they let themselves go to pieces, they don't take care of themselves, they don't eat properly, they don't look after themselves, and they're in shambles. And the Jewish people are not like that. But rather, we dress in Yom Tov clothes, and we have a special Yom Tov Seuda, Ochlim, Veshosim, Usmechim, Ubetuchim BaKadosh Baruch Hu Shi'asa Lehem Nes. In other words, ultimately the atmosphere of Rosh Hashanah, it's not one-dimensional. It is complex, because it is, shall we say, solemn optimism. Where on the one hand, we cannot do anything that perhaps may give an indication that we're not taking the day with full seriousness. Even Hallel, which at the end of the day is a mitzvah. But it's a mitzvah that has that celebratory aspect to it, so that we stop short of Hallel. But on the contrary, that it is because we take the day seriously, that is what gives us full confidence that our HaKadosh Baruch Hu will come through for us and will exonerate us. And so, as we approach the very special days of Rosh Hashanah, so we're cautious, but we're hopeful. We're serious, but we're optimistic. And there is much to be optimistic for, both in our personal lives and in our general lives and in our national lives, all of which are indelibly bound up one with the other. Mit Hashem, we're looking forward to a good year. HaKadosh Baruch Hu should bless all of us, Bechlal, Ubefrat, with a Shana Tova, Besuras Tovos, regionally, personally, in every level. We should all be written L'chaim Tovim, U'l'Shalom. Oh.